Welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 50. If you enjoy what you hear today, you can find us at becomecgpro.com or in our Facebook group. So today gives me great pleasure to welcome Mr. Adam Valdez. Adam and I have worked together in the past. He was my supervisor on The Lion King. And Adam's has done many very cool things in the world of computer graphics, coming from back in the day, back to Robocop and Jurassic Park, flash forwards to things like The Lion King. He's been a pioneer in the world of virtual production and has become a director. And Adam, it's just a huge pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thanks, man. Thank you, Ed. Good to be with you. Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you again, too. Also, I'd love to start. I know we talked about a little bit about this before, but how you got into the industry? How did you get into computer graphics?
Yeah, I guess. Okay, so I took some computer programming classes when I was quite young, like where you learn BASIC and, you know, those old original languages, and they were, you know, I'm 52 years old, so I was learning that stuff when I was 10. So that was like the early 80s, right? And, you know, so home computers were quite rare. And so you go to a place and they have a class and you would learn those basic things. So I kind of got some basic ideas of how computers work and get your hands dirty, you know. It wasn't really until the end of high school, which was the end of the 80s, where a friend's brother had a Mac and we were learning Photoshop. And so that was really my first proper, I would say, pro grade experience trying to do anything on a computer related to imagery. Before that, I was playing games and things like that, and not really dreaming that you could make games. I didn't really understand what any of that was, you know. My stunted university career involved a little bit of further programming stuff, and some film stuff. And then in what would it have been, like 1990 or something like this, Jurassic Park came along, first Jurassic Park. And so I basically learned Softimage then. Because I was working at Tippett Studio in California, and Phil was the overall like dinosaur guy on that movie. And it was originally going to be a stop motion movie that got turned into a computer graphics movie. So it was like suddenly the world flipped around. I think just having a bit of familiarity on computers was just a right place, right time thing. You know, we were working with ILM across the bay. They had just done Terminator 2 and Abyss and things like that. So, you know, we were all kind of figuring out how to do fleshy creatures for the first time, I suppose. And maybe not the first time, but, you know, at a certain bar. And so I kind of understudied with the stop motion animators, and they had this input device that would allow them to do the poses with this armature. And we captured that into the computer as like static poses. And so what started as kind of like smoothing it out turned into more like ongoing notes and having to actually, you know, invent and contribute a little bit animation wise on that show. Learned about color, digital color from Phil, scanning film, learning how to put film back out on, you know, digital images back out onto film and try to close a loop for digital color was quite challenging. So in those days, you know, we were all these young 20-something kids basically bolted into this very established stop motion company, kind of this brat pack, if you will, of kind of, you know, learning kind of on the job how to do things while trying to kind of mesh these two cultures together. And I think that really led to the last big show I did at Tippett Studios, which was Starship Troopers. And on that one,
such a cool movie.
Yeah, it's like one of those. I still look at it and think some of it really holds up quite well, actually. And that was like learning everything like how to go on set and survey and bring camera data back that you could work with, how to build a company with like hundreds of machines, and I think it was maybe 120 people or some 200 people or something, you know. So that was the end of that chapter, and so it was kind of like teenager into delivering, you know, computer graphics based movies. It was about an 8 or 9 year period that I worked for him. I just learned a lot about filmmaking and story, and a lot of lessons that I still carry with me today about, you know, approaching each scene and how you look at how it communicates and things like that. So very formative years, those 8 years there.
Right. Like a real mentorship, it sounds like.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You learned a lot, whether, you know, yeah, it was pretty intense.
So, what got you into the studio? Was it having the computer skills that they needed at that point?
No, I mean, I got an internship because I could make models and I was interested, and I got sort of through, it's not really nepotism, but my dad knew somebody who knew the Tippett people. And so I was able to get like just a hello visit and share some of the models I'd made in different things. And they gave me a job literally like just helping out around the shop at first. So the first thing I did was actually work with some of the people doing fabrication stuff, like model making type of things. It wasn't like, there was no grand way in. It was just sort of like a very initial sweep the floors, you know, do this, do that, kind of learning your way around. I think I was 18 or something like that, so 19. And then I stopped going to university at that point because it was sort of like, I need to do this, you know, like this is the thing I want to be doing. And here I am at least with a foot in the door. And none of us could have predicted that Jurassic Park would happen, right? That would be the next thing. So really I was there to do what I grew up on as visual effects, which had nothing to do with computers at the time, right? It was miniature work. That's what visual effects primarily was. And compositing shots together and stuff. Yeah.
That's cool. What an amazing point in time to be in filmmaking and see that massive transition from, I know there was a lot of disruption around that, a lot of people who worked in the traditional skill sets.
Yeah, definitely.
Being having to learn new skill sets or being resisting the new and trying to hang on to the old. Like, what was that like?
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to somebody earlier today about on set and the changes that we've seen there as well. You know, just how digital work has arrived and, yes, taken over certain things that would have been done in live action or in miniature work or, you know, in some other methodology. And I even remember a time when it was like, well, we will never do fire and water and hair and humans or any of that stuff. You know, you thought that's just the bridge too far. And now, of course, it's sort of like with all the years of watching craft happen and something like MetaHuman coming out of a company like Epic, you know, and seeing this incredible tool and product range that they're doing. And then watching AI sort of also suddenly say, hey, I'm actually going to jump over all the craft and techniques and everything and just get you right to the image, you know, like it's not that it's all there yet, obviously, but, you know, the definitely drawing a line through all that. The themes have been around what it takes to originate things from a page, you know, like you've always got to dream something up and write it and think about it and make it. I think the stuff that AI is writing, like I've played with ChatGPT, I've played with Midjourney to make images and all kinds of interesting things. I find it really fun. I find it really interesting. I can imagine that it will analyze the structure of everything that we make that's important to us, whether it's writing or imagery or whatever. And it will combine over time, you know, the analysis that comes out of like university programs with the incredible high sampling it can get from training data to really just describe in probably superhuman ways why some things work and some things don't, and maybe give you choices. And if you say, I like that, have it explain, well, this is the recipe I used to make it. And, you know, like that would be almost like having a university teacher with you all the time, where you get a really good editor that's saying, maybe this word choice, or I found this hard to read or whatever. And so you're seeing that, right? And with tools that you can say, hey, here's a sentence. Can you make it easier to read for me or more casual or whatever? And it can offer you ideas. I can see that all of that is what's happening. So On the one hand, I found ChatGPT really, rather than search, I'm going there and I'm like, if I have questions about things, I used to maybe give it a go on a search engine and just get a bunch of weird articles and irrelevant stuff. Here I can actually, you know, have a bit of a dialogue and get some drill down on something, which then gives me a new point of view, which is interesting. So I think like if it can continue to be useful in those ways, it's very interesting. But it is in the theme of, you know, someone in the past where you might have gone on set and you're putting up a big blue screen, maybe as the young digital guy, a little unawares of the fact that the whole set construction team is grinding their teeth over there because they would have built something there and you're just throwing up a blue screen. The truth is, though, of course, is that those guys, some of them, guys and gals, would retrain and become digital people and bring those skills across because a lot of the skills are the same. And so, yeah, it hasn't been always easy to be the digital person in live action situations. We've had a little bit of sabotage sometimes and a lack of cooperation other times and other things like that, you know. So I think like it's definitely, I'm sensitive to it. And now that AI is there and it just makes you think, my gosh, yeah, I always thought this visual effects CG stuff would just be fairly protected from like what further tech could there be, and here it is. Right. So, you know, it's like, yeah, it's interesting. It's left me a lot of time to think this year about it because I'm seeing so much stuff out there that I think is really amazing to see, and then either aesthetically I don't like it, or it's, you know, hallucinatory like some of it is, no, or whatever.
Trippy. There's a lot of AI stuff.
Yeah. So you know, like you can sort of draw a line on the trend and say, okay, yeah, that's gonna become very formidable. And I feel like what I hope is that I still find sometimes if I dive into a Nuke script or something on a really complex piece of work that I'm still frustrated that I'm, you know, in a grade node, nudging numbers in the 1,000th or 10,000th place, with what I feel is like still like a very primitive set of hammers and nails that I'm doing color work with, where I wish, you know, so you start to see like these AI coloring tools where you say, I love the palette of this image and I want to influence it. I wish there was something in between. Nuke is still amazing, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to poo-poo that tool. It's still a very impressive tool. I just find like I wish I had something between, you know, like the hammers and the nails, and something that's just saying to me, just tell me what you want and I'll get it for you. You know, like I think we need the AI stuff to fill those gaps in the middle, because I still think that the pressure on CG artists and this part of the industry in general to continue making amazing stuff no one's ever seen before, and this really rich imagery and all this mad, you know, photorealistic, complex, rich stuff with actors and worlds and all this stuff, like under pressure and time crunch and money crunch, like we need all the help we can get. And so sometimes I feel like the tool sets are still quite hyper manual, and I think we all need to sort of be moving. We do need some assistance. So yeah. if it can start to become this thing that aids us all, then I think it hopefully will balance out, you know, as a net positive. But who can tell right now what's going to happen? We'll see.
Nobody. Everyone's got a theories, but it's interesting. It's good to hear you mention that, especially off the back of the point about film going from film to digital, and now we're in that same ish moment, maybe different, but big change moment, going to real time and bringing in AI, yes, and machine learning.
Yeah,
there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of excitement. There seems to be a mix of both. Some people are scared that it's going to take all the visual effects jobs. Other people are saying, yay, get rid of UV mapping.
Yeah. I like I said, I hope it's somewhere in the middle. I hope it's a booster shot, you know. It is fun to play with it. But then again, I feel like a lot of it right now, anyway, you're at two or three steps away from the thing you just want. You know, so I think it's really hard, you know, to scale this industry and just expect that any artist you walk up to, you can say anything, pitch any concept. I think it's too bright. I think these colors are clampy. I want to feel more light energy, blah, 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 blah. And expect that you walk away and they got it. And, you know, maybe you weren't clear. Maybe they aren't experienced enough to pick apart your words and turn it into marching orders. You still need tiers of strong leads and seniors and different people who can interpret, especially if you've worked together before. You know, you still, that's hard, right? That takes a lot of work with other humans. So part of me is like, well, but that's always been a part of it. Having some robot you have to talk to and it's just interpreting your prompts in some other way, and you're like, what words do I need to use to get the thing I want? I don't really, that's what I'm saying. I'm not, that does not sound good. Like the AI images that I've made, it's amazing, but like, I don't know how derivative the images I just made, like how many sources it's just basically synthesized from, so that I'm basically just making a picture out of three other original pieces that three other artists made. And this thing it doesn't tell me what cocktail it's making from, right? So I can't see the bottles on the bar of the cocktail, like a bit of, oh, this is this kind of margarita or that kind of margarita. So, you know, ultimately that's frustrating because I don't really know how to repeat that success. And it feels again like the choices aren't specific. You know, I think in the work that we do with visual storytelling, it's like there's a billion choices every week that you're involved with, and you just want to go right to the correct thing. You know, you just want to be like, this is what it's supposed to be. And so anything that kind of makes that tough is hard. You know, it's just like non-optimal because you're just messing around. And then I mean, I'm sure everybody in our industry who listens to this will have experienced that thing where, whether you're making animation or a lighting pass or a DMP or something, whatever it is, or a model, like you make a first draft and sometimes it's just like, boom, there it is. Like whatever it was about the first draft, it's right and it works. We use the word that it works a lot. That's the phrase we say a lot in our work, don't we? That works, this doesn't work. So it's like, it's working. Okay, great. So, and we also know the days where we maybe don't have it or we're not totally sure on the brief or whatever, and our first draft doesn't work. And we all know that the ones that work just kind of sail through and you don't get a lot of notes and, you know, you just polish it and you're done. And the other one, you could be messing with that thing for 3 weeks now because you've put something up that doesn't work. And now it's like a committee decision about, well, what should it have been? And a lot of the times, I think when something that doesn't work is dissected, you're going to get notes that are more like, well, let's take this and see what, if we can, I don't know, modify it enough that it works. When it, maybe it, you know, you're kind of taking B and trying to make it something when you really should have had A.
Yeah.
And it's kind of just like, you know, it's not really the same ever, you know, like it may never be as great as it could have been. So I just, so that's the one thing about the all of the AI stuff is it is interpolatory and synthetic, and it does draw on other building blocks. So it kind of implies that maybe you're never quite getting the essence of what would have been the first right idea that could then be polished by trying to jump straight over every process step to a finished thing is not maybe, you know, very ideal for the creative process, especially for what we do, where, you know, every shot is a little part of a phrase, and it has to work also in a cut. And, you know, I mean, I'm not just trying to be like optimistic about our jobs. I'm just saying actually the nature of it doesn't maybe feel 100% conducive to a lot of what we do. At the same time, it was really fun to have a character idea in my head and spend an hour on Midjourney. And it's not the same as working with a great concept artist, but it was fun to just explore something quickly and knock it around and get these ideas and maybe start to throw a bunch of things away and say, it's in this neighborhood. None of these are right, but it's in this neighborhood. And I've kind of seen some things I 100% don't want. And that can actually be kind of useful, because you could go to an artist and say, see these things? These are the no's. This is the no pile. And there's something in here I kind of like that's interesting, we should chase. You know, that's a way to get a leg up on a process step, maybe. That can be kind of useful.
Right. Yeah, there's some things in the chat, people applauding the idea of UV mapping going away, at least some of those kinds of processes, which are very not many people like. They're quite satisfying when they're done in some way, but having to do them for every single thing is frustrating, and it gets in the way of you maybe doing more of the creative process, having more time, like we were saying earlier, about the pre-production phase, which is when all the creativity, more of it happens.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, every single craft would have a 20-to-1 ratio, right? Like you get to try 20 things and throw them out before you find the one that's the best thing. But in production, that's not usually the case. You have a little bit of time at the beginning to figure it out, and then you just got to run, don't you? So, I mean, yeah, I hope that's true. I think scaling visual effects is and CG work, animation, all those things. It's really, really hard still. I'm hoping. I mean, it's kind of crazy. So when I went down to Weta, which was pre-2000, I remember learning Maya for the first time, and moving from Linux to Windows, and you know, the animation department there, we used a lot of Windows and stuff. And it's amazing to me that, you know, Autodesk and Side Effects and the Foundry and all these companies, something like Nuke that came out of, you know, facilities in California and everything, we still kind of have the building blocks, don't we, of the last 20 years are all kind of still there. And I'm not trying to say anything negative about these venerable tools. They're all powerful and everything. But I do think, like, I've been doing more work in Unreal Engine lately, and that doesn't do away with the complexity. It's still a very technical application. You still have to know what you're doing. It isn't amazing that you can go via these new bridge products. You can bring in, you know, marketplace items and all these cool things. And we're seeing so much exploration in those spaces right now online, and every day on LinkedIn and YouTube, there's just all this stuff people are doing. It's really, really cool. But it is very technical, but it's generating all that opportunity and excitement, which I like. And it feels like, yes, real time, the AI stuff, whatever this metaverse thing turns into, you know, it's all a shift where we're starting to see the business to consumer industries, right? Like the Facebooks and the big game companies and everybody who makes things and interacts with, you know, millions and millions and millions of people, funneling some of that cash into computer graphics, right?
Yeah.
And knowing that it's kind of like enriching that, you know, humans are visual animals, and we love story and imagery, and we can get so much by watching. So it's like, let alone interacting with content, you know, so it's really interesting to see all of this stuff. So it feels like something is like tidal changing. There's a tidal change in the works. I've been saying to people, even if the metaverse is so boring as something like on the front of your fridge, there's a touch screen, and when you want to order more milk, you hit a menu and the milk carton is just twirling in front of you, and you can click and drag and read the back label and spin it around and click it and decide. That's, you know, like having an iPad type thing on your fridge is sort of a, right? Like that's as boring a thing I can think of as the metaverse could be, but it's kind of, I think, what, you know, the normal is going to be, right? If you, because there's all these buzzwords about metaverse, web three, etc. And I sort of think of it like, okay, web one, I guess, was like, what was that? Text and imagery. Web two HTML is like video.
Made it
universal. Yeah, web two is us right now, video streaming. And web three will be like, well, what's the difference between an application I booted on my desktop and a page that I go to where I play a game? I mean, it's like, you know, it's all in a weird way a little bit boring because you're just sort of talking about a different venue or something. But we could think of it more like the normalization or the raising of expectations that graphics are present and they're interactive and you can engage with them, and that makes a lot of things in our life maybe more fun, more rich, more informative, more whatever, you know. So instead of just seeing images anymore, now there's some sort of expectation that you can kind of play with it in some form.
My kids, they're like picking up pieces of paper and trying to scroll them.
Right.
Like
doing this or doing all the finger gestures. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a changing scenario. And I think that change of expectation plus the change of what business is. I mean, you look at VR, for example, and the new Apple thing and the Facebook stuff, and you're just like, that used to be us, right? You used to go to SIGGRAPH and it would have been the visual effects industry and computer graphics people kind of like innovating all this amazing stuff. And now I think that it's like, well, no, that you need to have consumer dollars too. You need a lot of money to innovate brand new hardware that can do all this incredible stuff. So, you know, it is really interesting. And I think the struggle for us as professionals is that with that normalization, there's a little bit of a blasé attitude towards the stuff we're making, you know. So all of the studios and networks become streamers are now facing a kind of what have you done for me lately audience attitude, which implies a lot of volume, which means we have to make more stuff. And then we get a little bit of a knock on the internet about those visual effects look bad or whatever. And it's like, they have no idea, right? Like,
no idea what we
got. What it takes. Suffering. But you know, like the idea of our industry trying to make what was, I mean, on that Jurassic Park movie, there's less than 100 digital dinosaur shots or something like that.
Right.
Very, very few.
Yeah.
And now you can have a.
That was about the right amount.
Yeah, the ratio. Now you can have like a romantic comedy that's got 800 visual effects shots. They might be relatively straightforward, but you know, I mean, the shot counts are crazy. So that's clearly those are the big, I don't know why we're talking 50,000 feet here, but those are the big trends, aren't they? Like that,
yeah.
Make the industry quite, I don't know, it's a mix of challenges and new cool things all at the same time.
It's giving access to more people. Before, when we got into computer graphics, it was a very small community, especially when you got in the 90s. I got into it professionally slightly after that, but it was still smallish community of nerds. And the people who actually cared about 3D graphics
was
relatively small. But now, as you said, it's shifting out and out and out into other groups, other industries. There's a lot more people seem to care about computer graphics now, partly because they have access to the tools. Like Meyer, and that originally was $50,000 for the software and $500,000 for the machine to actually be able to play. Now, a couple of grand for a half decent machine, some free software, and you can do something that's 50 times better in real time.
Yeah, my grandpa's story going back to Starship Troopers is I remember we bought a terabyte of storage, right?
Wow.
and a terabyte of storage, which now you can fit on a thing this big, in your pocket. It was like eight refrigerator size racks of disks with a giant, with a, two more giant refrigerator sized servers to serve the terabyte to the network. And the disks were $1 million and the servers were $1 million. So, now you got this thing in your pocket, and this was $2 million to have that much storage space. And we had to constantly rotate things on and off of it. So, yeah, that's my grandpa's story about
That's
back
a
in the
good one.
day. You know,
That's a good one.
it
I
has
remember the
a
first hard
lot.
drive I bought was 30 megabytes on an old Amstrad. And like you make frames that are bigger than that now, just a single frame.
Exactly.
It's
Yeah,
crazy.
it is a it is a very data and power hungry thing that we do, and that doesn't seem to be going away.
Well, tell me a little bit, because you mentioned a bunch of really interesting things. You ticked a lot of podcast bingo boxes for me through that. I'd love to hear a bit about your experience in making your recent short film, and because you made it in Unreal Engine. Tell me how that came about.
I've lived in England for a long time, and I got excited by the landscapes there and had these fairy world ideas in my head for a long time, a decade ago and or more, and had a notion for what could be a movie or a TV series or something, and picked that up again after the Lion King movie that you and I worked on, and started to kind of revive it in my head, and had written a pilot for a TV series and was talking to different people in LA about it. And then one of the producers I know in LA said, I think that there's this program over at Epic Games where they're doing grants and they're sort of supporting people who want to push the technology. So we had started using Unity game engine before and switched over to Unreal, and we were using it for virtual production things and learning it. And I was like, well, maybe this is a fit. So got the grant and started up on the thing. It's, a significant grant, it's not cheap, and I had an amazing team at MPC do the work. So it's not like a student hobby thing. It was, quite a lot to do. We worked on it for about a year. I mean, it was the team that went off it for a little while on and off. Sometimes, those short movie teams are, you get them when they're available, kind of a thing. So it wasn't the team for a year solid, but it was quite a long process. And it was great. I mean, we had a lot of help from Epic to pull it off. I think the facial stuff from MetaHuman was just really landing in a big way, and they also had their path tracing renderer, on the cusp of production ready. And so we benefited from, all the great people at Epic who got behind it and wanted to push it. We were sort of like, well, we could be here or we could be here. If what do you want? What do you guys want to do? And they said, well, yeah, let's go here. So they started putting time into the path tracer to add some features we needed and stuff to complete it. And colleagues who I've worked with before who are at Epic helped me in the background, pulling some strings and getting some great people in the MetaHuman team to advise us, I mean, and build some of the face rigs and everything. So I mean, we had a lot of help. We had a lot of help, which was great. And that was good, because I think I was very excited about what we could get done with their, the real-time graphics. There's the real-time graphics stream and the path tracing renderer, and you kind of decide which way you're going to go. In the end, we worked with the real-time thing most of the life cycle of the show and flipped it over quite late. Kind of did a Hail Mary and just flipped it over and relooked dev'd a lot of stuff, and and got that sort of just-in-time version of their code and rendered it out in time. And that actually felt a little bit like student filmmaking because, you know, we had a few boxes and we're rendering on boxes and hoping, you know, you go to sleep and you wake up and it hasn't crashed or your shot's done to see it the next day, things like that. So it's quite fun, small team and, you know, doing new things and trying all that new stuff at the same time was a little bit edgy sometimes, but it was great. You know, in the end, I'm quite happy with what we got and get a lot of nice messages from people going like, when's the next episode? I need to see what happens next. And the idea of it is kind of a teaser piece. It's been overall wonderful. I'm looking forward to making some more stuff in that little world pretty soon when I get a little more time.
So when's the next episode?
Someone give me some money and we can make some more. I'm going to do some little side pieces to explore some other little like vignettes that I can make with what I've got already. I mean, it's funny talking about the AI thing. I mean, you still need to originate characters and everything. You know what I mean? You still need originated stuff. You can't just literally like pop it open and make a movie. So, you know, any ideas I have, I kind of get always expensive ideas. That's the problem. You know, you want to do these cool things and it's like, yeah. So I do have some ideas about what to further explore with what I have in the bag already there. So we'll see.
Awesome. Well, it's beautiful. And I hope that you look forward to episode two.
Find it on YouTube. If you search for Brave Creatures, it's called on YouTube. It's all out there in the full quality version and everything.
Great. Now I'm sure that somebody will drop the link into the chat. Definitely check it out. So what was it like getting to make something of your own again? And a lot of the time we're in visual effects and we're making other people's stories.
It's a lot of fun. You start using those muscles and it is a bit tricky to sort of just make other people's shots. You know, it is for me bringing together all the things I've learned over the years from working with a lot of great filmmakers and helping make scenes better and stuff and designing things and whatever. You put it all together and it's quite a lot of fun. It's harder, you know, you're responsible for the whole thing, which is different, but ultimately it's pretty crazy to, you know, write pages, work with actors and they like it and they're into it and they get into a character and suddenly you see a character coming to life that you were dreaming of in your head and really like going with all of the organic things that evolve, like being open to what that actor brings, what the animators were bringing, what the character designer people were, you know, that's kind of crazy to watch from your page to the end, people jumping in and making it a real thing. You know, that's the most insane part, you know, the most kind of like can't believe it part. So that was a lot of fun.
That's cool.
Jackie's asking about top three programs to learn. Do you want to do that one?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. We have, thank you for bringing that up. We have a couple of questions from the audience. Somebody's asking, what are the top three programs to learn to complement our Unreal Engine skills to one day be hireable? Interesting question.
The top three programs. I mean, right now, if I was advising somebody who's like in school or something or just getting career going, I feel like you have to know Maya and Blender, right? Like those two seem to be the most ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But I don't think you have to deep dive into them. Maya is a very deep program. I don't know Blender well myself. And then Unreal Engine, yes, I would be learning that too. Unity's great as well, right? Like it's another good engine. I'm just trying to think. I might learn Nuke or Photoshop, you know, just like make sure you focus on color and image work as well. Because I think at the root of everything we're doing is still sort of fine art skills. You know, like, can you compose an image? Can you sculpt a shape? Can you place light on a character that makes it look? Yeah, and then on YouTube now, you've got so many YouTube and other resources now. There's so many online courses and all kinds of things, such as
I've heard. Yeah.
Yes, you guys, and like, you know, that there's plenty of ways to be learning fundamentals. I actually think I would not. I think young people sometimes make the mistake of thinking they have to master everything. Like, you know, oh, I'm going to learn Maya, but I'm going to learn every aspect of Maya. Yeah. And like just spin in place forever. And, oh, now I want to learn how to program Mel because I think it would be good that I can make my own shelf buttons. And now I've just learned about this whole world of shading and I'm going to deep dive. And I think what you should do is you should canvas it and learn the main ideas and become comfortable and then see what, not only what you like, but what you're good at and, you know, see what other people are responding to in your work. Sometimes you can not always have the chops for the thing you might ultimately want to do. That might be a 5-year goal, but you might be really good at something right now and just like let go with that. And if you have a never stop learning attitude, you're going to be fine, right? You can always move to some other discipline over time, I guess, you know, other skill set. But I think,
well, they
yeah, there's not fundamentally all that much difference between the tools, really, right? I mean, in terms of the basics.
So as you said, learning the fundamentals, the foundational skills about imagery and training your eye, getting a good eye, means you can move through tools. You can learn, sometimes you have to learn a tool in a day and be functional in it, in our world.
Yeah,
hopefully you get a little bit more than that, but it's
I like Unreal Engine is interesting because it starts, I give you this 30 seconds on it. It took me a while to really get the difference between game engines and the other ones, right? And the fundamental way I talk to people about it now is like, this is a piece of software that's for programming. You're here to write game code. It might feel like a DCC, but the fundamental nature of a game engine is you're making an executable that is interactive, and it's got all these amazing graphics tools interconnected to it. If you expect it to be Maya or Blender first, you're going to get confused and lost in it, right? And so it doesn't mean you have to be I'm not saying it's for programmers only. What I'm saying is that the paradigm of it starts with making code, right? So what does that mean? It means in a Maya or a Blender, you tend to focus on a shot, one run on a timeline. That's the core of the universe for that application. And it kind of says, where am I in time? Let me evaluate the scene graph. And that's the answer. So I'm going to draw this. The game engine is like, that's not where I start. Where I start is like, is there player input? What does the code say? Where do we start with the code? What is the game doing right now? We're on a tick. So on the next tick, what happens? Do I execute some blueprints that do some sort of procedural effects? Is there an input coming from an outside device? Like, there's so many ways that the next tick, it can evaluate what it should do. And so when I wish someone had taught me that. It's obvious when you're a game person, but it's not obvious when you've spent 20 years or in school focusing on DCCs, as they're called now. So I think like it's important to get the experience of both, you know, something that's very kind of like timeline focused, and this is my scene graph and it will evaluate exactly the same every time. And this is something that's dynamic, and now you bend it into a filmmaking or a storytelling mode, you know. So I do think people need to learn the range these days.
And so you being, I mean, you're a visual effects supervisor at MPC, working on Mufasa, a big Hollywood movie, but definitely talking about Unreal Engine and talking about Blender too, which is interesting. Is that now becoming part of bigger studios' pipelines? Is it
some of them? Some of them. I mean, I guess. To some, I'm seeing a couple of other questions about like how to use your time and should you do this and do that? Like there's always a lot of questions about sort of when you're starting or you're growing, like what should you be focusing on? And I think I'll try to button it up one more time. Like, yes, Blender is starting to be around. There's nothing wrong with learning Blender first. It's probably a slightly friendlier way in at first. And I guess the whole thing is like learn some software and never take your eye off the ball of art fundamentals, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's so many people that know Nuke and don't understand color. And color is one of the most complex things there is to master. And there's so many ways to end up with bad results really easily. So, you know, really spending time, I think I might be, it might come off like I'm saying two opposing things, which is like don't obsess over every detail and obsess over fundamentals. What I mean is like the each piece of software that's out there is a deep well that you could get lost in. So I guess my advice is just to sort of surf the top of them, get the ideas of them and learn a few. It's great if you're a lighter or an effects person and you learn Nuke and how to comp and work with color because you're going to make things that work better. If you become a specialist in that area, you're going to make things that work better for comp, right? Because you've learned how they come together later. If you're going to learn how to use cameras and block out space and be in the layout department or work in Previz or whatever, you're going to start to learn rules of space and how camera lenses and action work with each other. That's going to help you even if later you end up mostly lighting and comping stuff and focusing at the end of the pipeline, because your mind will think in space. And so I just think, like, if you think about all the things that are non-digital filmmaking things and all the fine art basics and the software, there's so much to learn that you're best served canvassing it all, and then you make a reel of stuff, make your own things, make whether it's your student reel or your personal projects or whatever, and the people at the companies will see what you're good at. They'll see what's right for you, where you're at, the things that where you shine, where you're maybe still a little bit rough around the edges and you need to work on it. They will help cast you. So I think it's one of those things in life, I guess, where you can't like 100% create everything you want, but you can be ready for the opportunities that come by being best prepared, you know? So I think to be best prepared is to study a lot of things, not too deep and get lost in any one, and then just make sure, like, when it comes to talking about photography or the composition of an image, we want the eye to go here in this shot, not there. My eye is going over there. I want it to go there. What do you do about that? You know, you don't need to have all the answers yourself, but it shouldn't be the first time you're waking up to how to compose a frame. Like, you should have done some work on what composition is about, that kind of stuff. So anyway.
No, it's great. It's great to know. And for a lot of people, especially wanting to get into the industry, it is daunting. I remember it being daunting for me, figuring out what do I learn. And I went and asked people and learned Maya because that made most sense at the time.
Yeah.
And I know that things are shifting a little bit, but I know that Maya is the mainstay 3D.
If you're relatively junior or coming out of school or whatever, I mean, most of the jobs that are going to be out there, it's like, can you demonstrate some basic sensibilities and do you have the basic proficiency in the software and are you a decent person to talk to and work with? You know, like, those are the main things. And if someone's got you on the phone and they're talking and they can just basically pick up the vibe that you're clever and you're switched on and you sort of have an earnest desire, I think our work is not a, someone in production was telling me that earlier this week, like, or last week, that this is not a regular kind of job. You know, there's a bit of a calling to do this. It's a very demanding, intensive thing. You got to really want to do it. Yeah. If you don't really want to do it and sort of work hard at it, if you don't have a little bit of seriousness to yourself about it, you're probably not going to enjoy it because it is quite tricky to do. I'm not saying we're amazing because it's hard. I'm just saying it's like, you know, it takes dedication.
Yeah.
You know, there is some dedication involved. So.
Yeah. It's hard work, but it doesn't feel like it necessarily.
When it's great, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody saying, I'd love to play a game based on Brave Creatures. Any plans?
You know, it's funny because I've had a few people already pitch the game to me based on like the little teases of the rules that are in the short movie, right? It's a fantasy, but it's based on the idea not of sort of like straight magic, but some sort of stuff around animal senses. And but yeah, somebody laid it all out for me already. And I was like, oh, okay. Nice. Like, here's how it would work and the different character classes, and you would have, this would be the game mechanic or whatever. And I'm like, okay, you know, so I was thinking about, now that there's Unreal Engine for Fortnite, I was talking with some people over at Epic about it. I don't fully understand whether you can, you know, basically have a Fortnite island that is whatever game you want, or whether it has to be like a shooting game, like a battle royale thing. Yeah. You know, are these islands sort of whatever kind of game you want to make, and it's just the Fortnite universe that you're in, or what? But because I mean, you could make a mini game in the sets that I have. You know, you could sort of make them real time. They're not really real time right now, but you could make them real time and make a mini game of some sort, I suppose, could be fun. I am tinkering with the thoughts about what you can do, since it's all sitting in Unreal. It's like this beautiful piece of work sitting in Unreal. I mean, that is the other thing, you know, as a global trend, Ed, about our industry is, for a lot of us that are in the storytelling part of it, you know, those rendered frames are the final result. And I think as time goes on, the worlds we make and all the 3D scenes we create and everything are going to have more and more value to them. For a blip, everybody thought, oh, you make a movie, make a VR experience. But it's like, it's a huge translation, right? And people didn't really want to spend money on the VR experiences, and it was not great. VR, nobody was getting it, and it wasn't really clear. Now I think with, you know, open world things, it's like very compelling to say in a movie we make quite an amazing world in one of these CG movies, and there's a lot of fun and exploration at a minimum that could happen there. So yeah, I definitely think in that direction now. It all takes money though. You need the money. So it's like you need people who also want to spend on it. I got approached recently on LinkedIn. There's a guy who's doing this whole crowdfunding of stuff. It's, you know, this is a really interesting time, right? People are like, maybe you can crowdfund I don't know. I don't know that I can do that, but you know what I'm saying? It's compelling. Yeah. Right? It's compelling.
Speaking of making amazing worlds, you guys made an amazing world in Prehistoric Planet. What was that like?
Oh God, that was great. I mean, so that was directing again, which in that case is like TV episodic directing, right? Like there's a writer producing team at BBC Natural History Unit who are just like the best people ever. And Apple's the production, the studio releasing it. BBC's the studio making it. John Favreau, executive producer, you know, just great team. And then a lot of it was taking storyboards and ideas they had for sequences and sort of trying to shape it a little bit for them, using my sensibilities about like, well, maybe, well, what if it's this, what if it's that? And then working through all of it in virtual production to basically shoot out and design and cut the scenes together. And then I turn over my director's cut, you know, like in TV, and you hand it off and they go off and final everything. So it was very, a lot of fun and sort of a dream job, because I'm sort of a science nerd and I have been watching the work of those people for so long that to turn on the TV and hit play and watch one of your ideas and having David, you know, Attenborough, like narrating your scene, yeah, is pretty insane. Sort of like life win bucket list for thing.
Sure. You know? Oh man, that's totally on my bucket list. I'm not sure it's gonna happen at this point, but yeah, I loved watching it. I mean, like it must be amazing to have gone from Jurassic Park all the way forwards to that point.
Oh yeah, that was like a slightly weird thing. You know, we didn't really want to talk about Jurassic Park or any of that franchise because we didn't really want to. It's best that you're trying to stand there on your own, right? But that global love of dinosaurs and animals and natural history documentaries, it's pretty crazy. People love that stuff. And I do feel a little bit like, again, without trashing anybody's work, I do feel that, like, you know, Jurassic Park, which I still proud of it and everything, but it definitely, you know, uses them as sort of this, I mean, I guess the moral of it is don't mess with nature, but at the same time, it's like, you know, they're kind of like scary, a lot of them. And to have the portrayals of them as, you know, natural, living, real creatures in their world, you know, that series really branches off of Planet Earth.
Yeah.
And what Mike was always saying to us was, okay, the Planet Earth series is not just about the animals, it's about little worlds again, you know, like little ecosystems and pockets of where everything is interrelated, you know, the weather, the land, the plants, the animals, the whole, like, little biome there, like whatever's going on there is a little pocket of the universe that is fascinating in so many ways. And so we want to really illustrate it in the round. And everybody's like, yeah, but dinosaurs, you know, come on, dinosaurs, you know,
make them attack each other.
Yeah, exactly. So there, exactly that. So it's kind of like, what are we going to do? So I think we were pretty successful in hopefully it just being fascinating and drawing you in. And I don't think I could help, my kind of Hollywood side came out a little bit sometimes, you know, wanting to do cool grand things and make it sweeping and fun, because there is a lot of that in their life also. But yeah, balance of those things, little intricate scenes, and shooting all of it during pandemic in my house, in my home, you know, in one room in my house, and having to edit it all together and send it in and do everything over the phone, that whole project, that was kind of crazy. But yeah, that was in between the two Lion King movies. That was what was going on.
That's cool. There's some shots in there that just look so real, that, like, it's the first time we've seen prehistoric creatures look that real. And it was really kind of trippy in that way, just to see that for the first time, that they felt like they were actually really, really there. And it was like watching Blue Planet or Planet Earth, which I loved. I watched
That's
got the
great
DVDs, but like, this felt like watching that, but with
that's great. That's what we wanted. We wanted people to just switch off their brain and think they were watching. Sometimes we had all these camera rules, right? Like, I did the episode in the first season called Ice Worlds, and we had this one sequence where these Pachyrhinosaurus, they sort of have the big horns, and they get chased by these predators through this ice waste. And there was this one shot I was doing, and I was like, I don't know if I can do this shot, but in my head, the camera operator is on the back of a snowmobile zipping along, and then they see the predator stops, the vehicle stops, and they were like, 100%, that's fine. You know, like, if you could sort of justify how you would shoot it for real, then we would use it. If it became too much like cinema, goofy cinema shots, it didn't really work. So yeah, we were really kind of adhering to our rules for coverage, etc. It was pretty fun. It's great.
Did you do like a lot of experimenting? Because I know then when they go shoot those things, they've got tons of footage that they go through and figure out which bits are going to cut together. I know
in
computer graphics, you can't really do that. Although with virtual production, maybe in between.
Yes, exactly, in between. So they would go shoot. So what's fascinating about them as filmmakers is they're very story driven, you know. So they would have maybe some news that, I don't know, a group of chimpanzees or lions or something, that some event is happening. There's a seasonal shift. There's a matriarch that's being challenged, and they feel like it's this summer, it's all going to come to a head. Something dramatic's going to happen. And so they have all these ties into the world, you know, just other people and scientists and research groups and ecology groups and all these people that are feeding in that they know, and largely research driven, new ideas, new research, bringing new stuff to their minds. And so they'll go out and do a story somewhere, not really knowing 100% what they're going to get, but they know why they're there, for something they're interested in. And they kind of know from the research how to engage audiences, you know, like what's going to be engaging. And so they do actually have a lot of script at the beginning. You would think there wouldn't be any, but there is quite a lot of shape. They get out there and they shoot, tons of stuff. And then there's a quite lengthy editorial process later. So in our case, we really need a locked cut before we go out. So, you know, we need a budget. We need to know how long the sequence is. We kind of need to know what the shots are. So there were a few cases where we would get a real specific location, and sometimes even a bit of LiDAR from the location scout or something. So we could actually shoot in a virtual space like you would do for a movie. And other times, remember this was during pandemic, you would have the desired location. Suddenly we find out we can't travel. No one can travel there. So we have to switch it up. And so we've been planning on one thing and you have to pivot to another. So a lot of variability on the attack plan at the beginning. So what we did was, and this is how I did the Unreal Engine short film and how we generally do previs, right? You take a scene and you divide it up into these beats. And so, a beat could be 5 seconds, it could be 30 seconds, depending on what you're looking for. But it's a little piece of continuous action. Now in movie making, of course, there's hardly a shot that doesn't have some custom rearrangement of the parts of the shot, whether that's a set piece or where the character's standing or the lights most of the time. But you can kind of start with what we call a master scene and lay it out. And then what I would do is I go into VR and I scout like crazy. I maybe have models of the dinosaurs and I kind of decide, okay, I've got this moment where these like big long-necked guys are going to come into a forest clearing. Okay, so I'm looking around the digital set we've made and I found the spot I want to shoot that. So I leave a few models in there for the animation team and I find a few like hero camera angles and I just leave those cameras and those models in the scene, give it to the animator and say, we're going to work here for this moment. And then we're going to jump over there to that other grove of trees for the bit where the dinosaur starts to push the tree over, because I've got a really nice group of angles there. So you're kind of combining the spirit of live action, which is to go into sets and find the places to work. The set's already been kind of designed for purpose, but exactly where you want to stage things, you need to find that when you're directing, right? Like, that's my shot there. Dinosaur stands there. So you put your marks in and you design your coverage, and then animation comes back, and that's when you start shooting, right? And so again, maybe I'll do some drone shots. I'll do like a long telephoto lens, like I'm in a hiding from the dinosaurs, safe and far away. And I'm just pan and tilt on a really long lens. And I just run those angles for the whole length of the 30 seconds or 10 seconds or whatever the animation is I have. And I bring all that in and it's very much like you have bins of footage. So now you're very much like an editor selecting exactly when you want to go to that camera and when you want to come back to it, building your coverage pattern that way. So when I would do my director's cut and they would say, let's try this and this, and I'd go shoot more. And then I'd say, here's the second cut, usually a couple of cuts, and they'd be like, great. And I turn over my bins of footage and to the BBC people, and they're just like, this is weird. This is almost exactly like getting footage from the field, because it's just running on and we can just, if we change our mind, like we would rather go to this shot here, we've got it. And so, very hybrid, like not just in terms of technology, but the approach, like that when you're making full digital stuff, I think everybody sort of thinks of filmmaking as you have a script and then you have a storyboard and you know exactly what you want and then you just shoot that and that's it. And I think in a lot of live action, I mean, you could think of there's Verite style or Terrence Malick or somebody, where the shooting is kind of wild and, it's very improvisational or it's inspired by what's transpiring literally that day on the set sometimes. So there's all kinds of ways. And I think you have to, the best is to hybrid it and have a plan, break your work down and know what the beats are and have in your head sort of like what you want to do, but then discover, be open to discovery. And that's where VR and all that stuff is really great, because it feeds into your brain through two eyes. You learn a space that way. It feels like you were there and you discover things that you probably would have left on the table if it was like, oh, I'm going to draw the perfect storyboard. I'm not a good storyboard artist. So like, and I think some people who think that way end up with kind of stock coverage that there may have been more interesting ideas you didn't really keep yourself open to, So in that way, it was really fun to sort of do a little bit of both.
To be able to play a little bit more. I got some of those sense memories still of spending so much time in VR
right
on the Lion King. Like,
yeah,
I just watched the movie finally. It felt like I'd been there already.
Right.
Like real actual physical sensation from that.
Yeah, like you, like your brain is like, oh yeah, I've been, I know that place. It's like you literally, the way I pitch it to people is like, if you've ever, if you can think of like a restaurant you've been to once and someone says, oh, describe it to me. You say, oh, well, let's see. Like you kind of come in on this side near the street and there's like a waiting area. And then in the end, there's like the bar and like the doors to the bathroom are in the back corner. And there was like, I don't know, this like all these really cool wooden tables over here. And that's, I sort of remember it. And it's like, you know, you're kind of remembering the space as much as you are like images of the restaurant. And I think that's because you literally were there for an hour. But you might have like walked back to the bathroom and back or whatever, walked up to pay. And just by being around it, you don't realize that your brain is mapping it. Your brain automatically maps spaces everywhere it goes, whether you know it or not, right? So VR gives you that connection to spaces that is quite hard. So I think that's it's interesting because a lot of the artists on a movie who weren't on the set can really struggle to judge the space by just looking through lenses. Like they're not really clear, like, oh, that's a, no, that's not like 20 feet. That's like 300 feet. Like that's not the length of a room. That's like the length of a big hall in a big public building. Like it's a completely different thing. Like, oh, okay. You know, so like they're not putting the right amount of Atmos in or other things because they're just not fully getting the spaces. You know, they're, it sucks if you haven't been able to be in the set space because you're just not getting all the info anyway.
Yeah it's cool to hear that the process that went into it, and I was very curious about that on the prehistoric planet. We got a couple more, I know we're going over slightly, but we got a couple more questions if you have a few more minutes. Yeah, somebody's saying, do you use mocap suits, using them with your projects? If so, what's your favorite mocap suit? Well, like, I guess, do you use mocap?
So on my short movie, I did not use motion capture. That's all keyframe animation. And part of that was because I, okay, so the characters in that are nine inches tall, about 22 centimeters tall. And
they have mocap suits that small.
Yeah, exactly. Little rod puppets. And it's a slightly interesting story there, I guess, depending on what kind of nerd you are. But like, this is all related. I didn't like the idea of using mocap suits because I thought they would feel physically big, right? They would move too much like big people. And, you know, motion capture is really at its best, I feel, when you're not messing with it too much. You know, you're using it for what it's all. I mean, it's a very fidelity-based tool. So if you don't like what the motion is, you're going to be in trouble.
Thinking of Jungle Book as you're saying this.
Well, yeah, there we were using it for previs, right? And yeah. I think it's perfectly good for that, actually. And we continue to do that. And motion capture, of course, is a great tool. But in this case, it just wasn't the thing I wanted. So, so we started keyframing stuff. And then the next interesting issue was, what should the camera feel like? People were saying to me, oh, yeah, you're going to make them move like little birds or something, right? Because they're so tiny. And I thought, oh, shit. Like, what, does that mean that the camera needs to feel like I'm there trying to film somebody tiny? You know, so it's like bumping around and I'm struggling to keep them in the frame because they're bouncing around like little tiny things. So we did some experimentation with that, like maybe that would feel cool. And then the problem was all these ideas just take you out of the piece, you know? It became funky, like jittery and bumpy. And I was like, I want it to feel like cinematic. I want it to feel like an epic, like a big world. Just from this point of view, not a little world. I wanted it to feel like a big world. So ended up shooting it. Actually, the whole project is in human scale. So those characters are not 22 centimeters tall in Unreal. They are 5 foot whatever. And it's the trees and the plants that are huge. And so it was also if you work too tiny, I mean, depth of field, you get all kinds of problems
everything
in CG
breaks,
as well.
lights,
Everything gets too difficult. So we worked in a big scale and a normal scale, I would say. And that meant, you know, I did all my camera capture with this tool called Dragonfly.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I think they're watching.
Oh dear. I better say something nice.
Be nice.
And so I basically have it on my iPad shooting all my Dragonfly cameras. And it's really nice because you can audition lots of takes and put smoothing on the fly. And you can be a bit crappy and smooth it and strike a balance. And, you know, sometimes I just put the iPad on the table and do a dolly shot, sliding it across the table. Sometimes I put it on a tripod and actually shoot it, you know, use it as like just a motion capture device to record pan and tilt. And other times I will scale myself up, like, you know, I'll scale the movement like 300 times and I can be like a helicopter just by moving my arms like this. And so I shoot all these kinds of cameras and bring them in. And I felt like that was ultimately the right choice because I didn't really want the camera style to make you feel like, so I guess what it is in the end is it's supposed to feel like a little camera person in there with other little people shooting them, like a little camera crew, you know, at their size or whatever. So everything for them is quite normal. And yeah, so in a weird way, I could have used motion capture, I suppose, because them moving normal-ish would have been okay. But, you know, I'm a big, I just love keyframe, and I love when an animator has, here's the line, and goes from the line straight to the performance and incorporates face and body all at the same time, and it sort of feels all of a piece. And I had this great animation team who were so giving in like recording themselves for reference and letting me choose which facial take we were going to go with. And yeah, really cool. So that, for me personally, that's a process I like. But motion capture is great, and it's very useful in many other situations.
Yeah, well, look at the right tool for the right job at the right time. And Glassbox says thank you. They were proud to support creatives like you.
Nice.
So someone says, what's your preferred coding language? That's an interesting question.
I don't have, you still I can't do? Code. I can't write, so.
Right. So none of them. somebody else says, what's it like winning an Oscar?
It's a long time ago. It's been a while. What's it like? You know, I'm going to sound really jaded, but I really, for a long time, tried to put all the awards stuff to the side because I think you need so many things to sort of happen at the same time to be selected on any given year for something like that. You know, you have to be on a show usually that's pretty innovative or very artistic in some interesting way. When it comes to Oscars, I mean, you know, it has to be fairly popular. I know there's a lot of artsy movies in the Oscar nomination stuff, but for the visual effects-y ones and the sound ones and stuff, you're kind of counting on that crowd seeing your movie. And then who are you competing against that year, you know, and were you the supervisor on it to even be on the list of people? You know, so many things have to align for it that to even kind of hold it out as some sort of hope or goal is not smart. And then you win one, and then it sort of poisons you because you won another one. It's like, oh, that was cool. Can I get another one? You know, so actually I got nominated for The Lion King right after and didn't win that one. And so I'm one for two, I'm 50-50, you know, nominated twice and won one. And so you got both experiences to go there and dress up and do all the stuff and lose and go there and win. I found it all quite intimidating and stressful, actually. It's quite a lot, you know, your kind of heart's beating in your chest when you're sitting there and you know that your award category is coming up. It's quite intense. After all the intensity, you can say, I mean, you know, I think Jungle Book is a great movie, and I think we did something quite innovative, and I think there's a lot of art in it, so I'm very proud of it. So I think, okay, I feel like we earned it, you know, that's cool. I'm glad people liked it and they recognized it, so I'm grateful for that. But yeah, it's weird, man. You have to forget about it then. You can't get hooked into that stuff. It's just too strange, you know, and there's politics inside those academies and those awards bodies, and it's just part of it's a little bit icky. But it would be horrible for me to be like, eh, about it. It's very cool, right? It's a very cool thing to have accomplished, but then you have to put it away and forget about it. So,
that's a great and complete answer. somebody, the last one here, someone says, do you use storyboards when you come up with an idea and then turn it into a film, or do you have another process for converting initial idea into that final project? I mean, you kind of spoke to this a little bit.
I can say one thing about that, though. I'm not a storyboard person, but I think for some people that's probably right. I think this is the best advice I can give on creating from scratch, is because there's a lot of camera styles, there's a lot of cutting styles, there's a lot of lens choices, there's a lot of staging things you can do. And I think, like, the way you should think about it is visual storytelling, cinema, TV, all this stuff, it's really about, you know, what's in the frame and what you cut to, basically, right? So, you know, if you have a camera sat on somebody and then you cut to something else, we all know from film school sort of teaching that you have those Eisensteinian rules, that it's the cut of one thing to another that kind of creates the interconnecting, what the audience receives. You know, it's not just one shot, it's how they work together. And you can also then look at, when you're writing on the page, how words and phrases make a sentence and a paragraph, right? So if you start to, as a person who's, if you're like a writer, director, aspiring to do that, you want to just start equating those two things. When you write a script, you know, you don't write, this person is thinking this. You have to think about something that can happen in front of the camera that helps the audience understand what the person's thinking, which is one of the hardest things to do. It really, you can moreover convey how they feel through their face, you know, how the actor is being, that's immediately transferred, right? So if you're reading a book and they say, this person was thinking this, and they were remembering the time when their dad said that, and then all those memories and disappointments, it's like, you can't write that in a script, right? You have to say, like, what is that like on the outside? Is that person, and the actor really is going to do that. So you don't even write it all down. You're sort of like, this is the moment I need. Person comes into a room and they're rifling around in their desk drawer looking for something and they can't find it. And then what do? They kick the desk drawer, they punch the wall, or do they just get really sullen about it and really moody about it? Or like, what happens beginning, middle, end in each beat of a scene, and what turns in that scene? So you're writing it and then you're thinking about, what are the shots that tell it, right? So I think if you look at the filmmakers that are, I was just watching a thing about, what is it called, Rocketville, the new Wes Anderson one. And he's so much about compositions and the way he's using dialogue and shots construction and set construction and everything. You know, there's a kind of an artifice to it. It's very cool. I'm not saying artifice in a bad way. It's very constructed, and you're very aware of the construction of how you receive it, right? He's not going for a fly on the wall effect where you're just like the observer of something that's just playing out. He's constructing every image that you see, and the camera often moves from one composition to another. Sometimes characters enter the shot, you know. I mean, it's very staged in a certain, very deliberate way for a certain style of effect, and connected to the kind of storytelling he's doing, they marry together really nicely. There's other stories where the subject matter is very naturalistic and you kind of wouldn't want to be aware of the camera or something. So I think you really have to look at the thing you're trying to do. What is the script or the story or the moment trying to be? And do you want to lean into that or play off of it in a more conscious way where the audience is more aware of the filmmaking? Or do you want to make it kind of invisible filmmaking? Those are the places to start. And so is storyboarding a part of that? I don't know, maybe for some people, like, not for me so much. I write the stuff and I sort of see the moments in my head. Like, I can imagine the actions. I think being an animator for a long time really puts you in touch with action. Like, you're just very much like think in action. So if I'm writing something, the sentence is, you know, he walks into the room, he crosses the thing, And then I might do period break, hands rustling around a desk drawer, because I'm not going to say he puts it, he opens the drawer and starts looking for things.
Right.
What I'm imagining is a cut to the hands are already in the drawer. I might even jump over the opening of the drawer. I don't know. You're probably going to shoot opening the drawer and going in. But while I'm writing it, I'm like, you almost speak like caveman speak. Jack opens the door, walks across the room, dot, page break, you know, like next thing, hands rustling around, searching, picking up a pen, tossing it back in the drawer. But you can put something like, that's not what he's looking for, or something. You can actually put in some notes to yourself, you know, that make it clear what that is. And then later on, you know, you're just like, okay, there's a camera here looking at the desk drawer and the hands are rustling around. Rather than say a camera on the side watching a full figure person messing with a desk, you want to see the hands and the frenetic energy of them rustling through the contents of the drawer. So like the more you can sort of come up with your ideas as shots already, as punctuated actions, and less like literary minded person thinking this or whatever, you and force yourself to think like a silent movie maker, you know, like what is the action that someone would do that would help me understand what's happening with them right now, or what just happened between two people. I think if you start there, some people are going to be like, well, I'm not very good at drawing, and the advice would be draw a stick figure.
Yeah.
If that helps you just be like, I think it's a wide shot of him standing at the desk, whatever. If you get a bunch of post-it notes and you draw them one post-it note at a time, and then build a little cardboard thing where your phone is sat, where it snaps in, and you just take a picture of every single one so they're the same, you know, build yourself a down shooter out of cardboard and just shoot your own pictures, bring them into Premiere and cut them and time stretch it, you'll start to be directing. Like, you'll start to learn, go to that shot, go to that shot, go to that shot, you know, like, or write a stupid story like I just made up in a room that you could shoot with your phone with your buddy and just shoot it, and nobody ever has to see it. But go from stupid dumb idea on a page to, hey, you, would you be my actor? Use your phone, shoot shots, cut them together. You'll just be learning so much about what you think it should be and what you like. And so you start to equate it. Then the next time you're writing or coming with an idea, you'll already be thinking in shots. And that's the thing that learning people have to get over, is starting to think about cinematic storytelling, not so much about each step in the process, but just that you're already thinking in sort of a shot form, like, shot of this, shot of this, shot of that. And I think once you learn that, you can go back and you can analyze movies and you can watch masters and see how they do it. And you will now appreciate and learn more from what they're doing for having tried it yourself. It's kind of like watching sports, you know, like if you don't really know the rules of it, or you've never even been on the field and thrown a ball or something, you're sort of just watching something that seems quite arbitrary. But like if you see into the layers of it, now you watch it, you understand there's a lot more going on than might seem to be clear. So I think those are the main pieces of advice for young students and learners and other people. Like, focus on fundamental things. And if you're interested in all this stuff, just go do it at the most cheap, boring level possible, as fast as you can. You literally could make 4 stupid ass scenes in a weekend that don't mean anything. They don't have to be important, you know, just try stuff and then cut stuff. And then you'll be like, whoa, what if someone says, hey, lay out a sequence in Previs? And you can be like, well, at least I've put a lens on some stuff, you know, like I have an idea where to start or how I would approach it. That's that theme of just being prepared for the opportunities as they come in this work. Just, you know, keep trying stuff. And I think that having a kind of a learner's attitude for your whole career. I'm still learning all the time. And I think for a lot of people I know in my position who've been doing it for 30 years or so, the day you stop feeling like you're challenged or you're learning, you just like, why do it? You know, like you want it. We're very lucky to be doing this in the first place, but it can get to be a drudge if there isn't something for you in it, right? So that's partly your attitude about like, just keep trying new stuff and give it a go.
Yeah, that's great advice. I had in the middle of, I've been doing it professionally about 16 years or so. I'm in the middle. I had a little bit of a lull in passion, and it was absolutely that. I wasn't pushing myself. I wasn't learning. I would just, I'd worked so hard at the beginning. I was like, I want a little pause, and that pause lasted for slightly too long.
Well, life happens too, right? You have kids, you know, you can't be relentless, but I think, yeah, you'll have career phases as well. And, you definitely want to be, moving forward in your artistic arena, especially. I think there's a lot of people who don't want to supervise, for example. Sometimes I don't want to supervise anymore, you know, like, right. Like it's very fun to grab an iPad and shoot as opposed to, supervising a lot of people. It's fun to sometimes sit at the box and do some comp work or something to stay connected. I think like there's some of the best artists are like, yeah, I tried being a lead or a CG soup or something for a little while and I hated it. I just want to sit and make cool stuff. And I'm like, totally respect that. That's totally cool. And then you want to make sure that they're going to be satisfied by getting to author things and invent stuff, you know? Otherwise they'll look for an opportunity where they can, right? You know, because they know that that's the thing that's driving them.
In the storyboard sense, and this will be the last one I ask you, now you have a 3D tool that works in real time, that's very good at prevising, that you can jump into kind of quickly. Does that in some cases become the storyboard, that you can do a 3D storyboard effectively?
Yeah, so if I'm reading somebody else's script that I haven't written, I'll still sort of sometimes, like if I have to break it down, I'll in the margins of the script or something put like wide shot, single, you know, you can shot list, you can say wide shot, single on, so over him to her, over her to him, full shot as they move, or you know, you can sort of imagine in your head like where the close-ups are, where the wide shots are, that kind of thing. So you can sort of catalog it a little bit. What I do in VR is I'm looking through a lens, so it's really like being on a set with a viewfinder, and you're sort of deciding like, oh, that's a nice composition, right? Like in a sense, but doing that VR scout is the first time I'm really finding the exact camera positions, and that's when I'm staging. See, so like, I think after you've done it for a while, you can read a script and you can imagine the shot types, but it doesn't mean you see the exact composition in your head. You just know kind of how you might punctuate things for clarity, right? Because above all, there needs to be some fundamental clarity for the audience of what's going on and if they can see it. You know, it can be very odd. For example, if you're cutting a dialogue scene, it's fine to be on the character who's listening because the reaction of the character who's listening is sort of more important than, it's what the audience needs to understand or know in that moment more than whoever's talking. But if you stay off the person who's talking for so long, you start to get disoriented because you lose touch with that other side. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that come out in editing that are little rules of thumb, but generally speaking, you can kind of rough storyboard pretty roughly, you know, just by shot types, like wide, close up this, I want to be punched in on that and see her face really clearly, whatever. The VR part really is the next bit, which is like, okay, now I'm in production effectively. So I know I have this moment on the page. I know in my head that it's like, whenever I read that, I'm like, whoa, those dinosaurs are going to come in, or this fairy girl is going to be flying over or something. And I can imagine that could be really beautiful with backlight, you know, God rays and all the cheesy stuff you can put in and make it beautiful. So you're like, I kind of know I want something in that neighborhood. It's when you get into the space and you start looking around that you realize that you could shoot the up angle of the same moment looking this direction and the facial close-ups in another direction if you need to, because you just like the backdrops better and they're going to cut and the audience isn't going to know that you're cheating the space, right? But other moments, I mean, there are famous rules like the 180 degree rule that you can break or not break depending on what you want to do, generally I don't, but like, I remember in my short movie, I started right to left, which a lot of people are always left to right in scenes, you know, like characters walking left to right, sort of like we have this Western bias towards left to right as the dominant flow of a scene. And I went into the set and I was like, nope, I'm saving that view for the last shot in the movie. So I don't want to show that view. I don't want to show those mountains. I want to show this open field. And also the way the set came to me, all the best shots are looking that way. So she's going to come in right to left. And in fact, they end going right to left as well. You know, so that's how that set panned out. And it is what it is. You know, I found the places I wanted to work that way. So I was translating the things in my head and the general idea of kind of how coverage would be to what the set was offering me and was looking best. And realizing that, like, okay, she's gonna hide in these little bushes here, but when she has to run for her life, we're gonna jump, you know, like hundreds of meters way over here, and we're gonna shoot the run here. And that's just the way you make movies in real life. You cheat space a lot, you know, because you just like what the environment's offering you. And it, as long as you can make it kind of cut and it flows, then you get away with a lot of cheats. And so that's my way. It's kind of jump over boards and go from rough coverage in my head or like in scribble notes to scouting and finding it once I have a space to work in, rather than say, oh, I am going to have this brilliantly composed shot where there's a teapot here and a plant over there and the windows. I mean, it's like, you know, you can kind of get bogged down and boarding a little bit sometimes, like overthink it too, right? Because unless you're going to draw it, right, unless you're like more in a 2D controlled space, or maybe you have your set built and you're placing cameras in that and you take a snapshot of your set and then you draw your characters in on top, you know, so you can sort of use a scout as a first snapshot for a board. Lots of ways to do it now. Lots of ways.
Wow. Well, can we bring you back for episode 100? I feel like there's more.
Sure.
There's somebody saying here in the chat here, Adam needs his own masterclass. Maybe you could come do one for us.
Sure. Let's do it.
You heard it here, folks. We have our first CG event coming up called CG Summit. It was a 2-day event, which I was going to make an announcement at the end of the podcast here. Seems like a good moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, Adam, I miss working with you, and this has been a
wonderful. Oh yeah, man, I know. Yeah, indeed, it was good to see you again.
You too. Yeah, and thank you so much for taking time out of your off evening, I guess, at this point.
Of course. Yeah, it's always fun to chat about this work. It's cool stuff. We're lucky people, and it's good. There's a lot of endless wells you can go down analyzing it and talking about it. So always fun to chat about.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way. Yeah, thank you very much for coming and sharing your experience with us here.
You bet.
Look forward to the next opportunity to do it.
Okay, man.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. You. Take care.
Thank you, everybody out there as well. Thanks to our listeners. Thanks for asking great questions. And yeah, if you're interested in the CG Summit, it's coming up on July the 22nd and 23rd. We will post some links to that, I'm sure, in the chat. If you enjoyed today, we'll have another episode in 1 week's time. It'll be Alex Pierce talking about Blender topically. But yeah, follow us at becomecgpro.com. And it's been a great pleasure. Thanks again, Adam.
Okay, man.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Jackie. Bye, guys.
See you all soon.